Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, August 29, 2016, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss pipeline takings. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to have two experts with us. We'll hear opening remarks from each and then a rebuttal from each. We'll begin with 10 to 15 minutes of remarks and then 2 to 3 minutes of rebuttal. We'll hear first from Professor Ilya Soman. He's a professor of law at the George Mason University School of Law. That's now the Antonin Scalia Law School right here in the Washington, D.C. area. He'll be followed by Professor Alexandra B. Klass. She is the Distinguished McKnight University Professor at the University of Minnesota School of Law. With that, Professor Soman, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking the Federalist Society for organizing this call and Alex Klass for participating. She's one of our leading experts on pipeline takings, perhaps in the entire country. And the idea of using eminent domain to condemn property for pipelines is not a new one. It's been going on for decades. However, there has been an increase in these pipeline takings over the last 7 or 8 years, particularly with the energy boom that has occurred in many states. And simultaneously, there has also been an increase in opposition to these sorts of condemnations on both the right and the left. So I'll start out by briefly talking about the controversy over pipeline takings. Then I'll talk about some of the methods by which we can potentially mitigate the problems that these sorts of condemnations cause. In some cases, they can be addressed by stronger enforcement of constitutional limits on the use of eminent domain and protection of property rights. In other cases, we could have more policy or legislative reforms that could prevent abuses in situations where the takings in question are constitutional, but are still potentially causing more harm than good. So as I mentioned earlier, there has been a great increase in pipeline takings over the last 7 to 8 years as oil production in the U.S. has increased and a number of other kinds of energy production as well. And this has stimulated a backlash from an interesting coalition of environmentalists on the left and also property rights advocates on the right. These groups have worked together in a number of states to try to curb or even abolish pipeline takings. What are the sorts of problems that are caused by these condemnations? Well, first and most obvious, in many cases, they undermine people's property rights and may even forcibly displace businesses, homeowners, farmers, and so on. The displacement is not as great as it is with takings for conventional private economic development or for the alleviation of so-called blight and promotion of urban renewal. Those sorts of takings sometimes displace hundreds or even many thousands of people. Such large-scale displacement is rare for pipeline takings, but you do certainly often get smaller-scale displacement of property owners. In addition, environmentalists argue that these sorts of takings often also cause environmental harm, for instance, through leakage from the pipelines or even just from the mere existence of the pipeline itself, which may damage the environment, cause harm to wildlife, and so forth. So therefore, sometimes there are a variety of indirect harms as well. Finally, in many cases, the pipelines are pushed through, at least in part, by interest group lobbying, particularly in states where energy companies have an outsized lobbying power. And this sometimes means that the pipelines get built and people get forcibly displaced, even though it's very questionable whether they create more economic benefit than they cause harm. So there are a variety of potential harms caused by these takings, though for reasons I'll discuss below, it doesn't necessarily follow that they're always on net harmful. As a result of the controversy that has arisen over these sorts of takings, several states have actually passed reform laws recently to either ban these takings entirely or at least constrain them. That has recently happened both in the state of Georgia and in the state of South Carolina. In South Carolina, the State House of Representatives actually passed a reform law by an overwhelming 889-3 vote, and it actually bans for the next 3 years any use of eminent domain for the transfer of property to private for-profit pipeline owners. Also, a number of state courts have in recent years ruled that these sorts of takings should be constrained under the state constitution or state statutory law. For example, in Texas and Kentucky, the courts have struck down some takings for the benefit of private pipeline owners, either because in the case of Kentucky, the private pipeline owner was not a public utility, or in the case of a Texas pipeline, that it was not a common carrier. And a number of other states, the state legislature is considering possible reforms, even if they haven't been actually been passed as of yet. And in each case, as I mentioned previously, the reforms are being pushed by an interesting coalition of left-wing environmentalists and primarily right-of-center property rights advocates. So you have an alliance that cuts across conventional ideological and political lines. This, of course, in some ways is similar to the very similar right-left alliance that we saw in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's most famous decision on eminent domain, the Kelo case, which happened a little more than 10 years ago. In that case, a narrow 5-4 Supreme Court decision ruled that it is permissible for the government to take private property and transfer it to a new private owner in order to promote private economic development. Although the federal constitution, like almost all state constitutions, says that property can be taken only for a public use, Kelo ruled that a public use could be pretty much anything that might benefit the public in some way, even if the new owner of the condemned property is a private entity. And in the aftermath of Kelo, there was a tremendous backlash with 45 states passing reform laws. Most of those reform laws targeted only condemnations for economic development or for blight. They didn't touch, for the most part, pipeline condemnations because conventional pipeline condemnations, many of them at least, are permissible even under a narrow view of public use. The narrow view of public use, which was the alternative to what was done in the Kelo case, holds that there is a public use either if the new owner is a public or governmental entity or if it is a common carrier that has a legal obligation to serve the entire public. And the most pipelines, though not all certainly, are indeed common carriers. However, a few state post-Kelo reform laws do have provisions that potentially at least affect pipelines. I know Alexandra is going to talk about this in her presentation. And even in the many states where pipeline takings were not directly affected, the controversy over Kelo and the political reaction to it focused attention on other forms of eminent domain abuse, even the ones that weren't directly at issue in this case. If you want to know more about the tie-in between Kelo and pipeline takings, I cover it in my recent book about the Kelo case and its aftermath called The Grasping Hand, available on fine internet outlets near you. So what can be done about these sorts of pipeline takings? Well, one thing that can be done to curb abuses is, in fact, tighter enforcement of public use constitutional restrictions on condemnations. For reason I explain in my book, and I'd be happy to talk about in questions, I think the Kelo decision is wrong. And if this is so, at least some pipeline takings do violate the public use clause of the federal constitution and many state constitutions because there are a good many pipeline takings which are for pipelines that either are not common carriers or even though in theory they've been said to be common carriers, in reality they actually aren't. As Alexandra Klass has shown in some of her writings, sometimes the common carrier requirement is honored much more in the breach than in the observance. Some state courts have begun to crack down on this in recent years, but more can be done along these lines. Another thing that we can do is states, and in some cases the federal government, when it's federal taking, can do a better job of enforcing the doctrine of necessity, which says that even if there is an entirely legitimate public use, the government needs to prove that it's actually necessary to take the property in question to achieve the public use, in this case, a common carrier pipeline. This, too, when it comes to pipelines and some other kinds of takings, often isn't observed as rigorously as it should be, and as a result, often property gets condemned to a greater extent than is truly necessary. Obviously, as I mentioned before, many pipeline takings probably do pass constitutional muster, and here I think statutory and reforms could be useful to impose stronger and tighter cost-benefit analysis of these takings to show that there really are substantial and clear net economic benefits from these condemnations, even after you take account of the forcible displacement of people and businesses and so forth. Obviously, such cost-benefit analysis are never going to be perfect, and it's often hard to measure the cost of takings, something I'm happy to talk about in the questions in more detail, but in many cases, we can at least do better in the kind of rubber stamping that sometimes currently takes place with these sorts of condemnations. It is not my view that pipeline condemnations should be banned completely. In some cases, there are very large economic benefits to new pipelines that can swamp these sorts of costs. And as I discuss more fully in my book, I think with pipeline condemnations, there are sometimes genuine holdout problems which are more severe than those that exist with conventional private economic development projects. But even though I don't think they should be banned completely, they should be more tightly restricted than is currently the case. And I think more can be done to achieve that goal, both through enforcing constitutional restrictions on takings and through policy reforms or legislative reforms, though I think some of the legislative reforms may be difficult because in many states there are powerful energy industry special interests that will tend to oppose them. So in conclusion, I think this is a growing and important problem, but it's also an area where people of different political views can and have worked together in a constructive way, and I hope to see that continue and grow over time. I'll now turn it over to Alexandra, but I very much look forward to the rest of the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Ilya, and I'm happy to participate in this conversation. As you can tell from Ilya's opening presentation, these are very interesting times for eminent domain and energy infrastructure. And eminent domain has always been a part of how we build infrastructure in this country. If you think about the interstate highway system, oil pipelines, natural gas pipelines, natural gas import and export terminals, and electric transmission lines. And it's really important to note that in the United States, apart from the highway system, it's the private sector that's building this infrastructure. And as a result, state governments have delegated eminent domain authority to private parties. So when we're talking about pipelines, whether they be oil pipelines or gas pipelines, we're not talking about the government exercise of eminent domain, but it's private party eminent domain. Now, this typically has not been all that controversial as a legal matter, even though, of course, there have always been opposition to particular projects by landowners and environmental groups and others for decades. But what has changed recently, as Ilya noted, is the amount of energy infrastructure that we're building, and concentrated efforts by legislators, environmental groups, property rights advocates, and landowners, often working together really for the first time, to use the eminent domain laws in different ways and change those laws in some circumstances. So for some groups, the goal is enhancing private property rights. For other groups, the goal is environmental, making it difficult to transport fossil fuels to reduce the country's dependence on these sources of greenhouse gas emissions in favor of carbon-free energy resources. So I'm going to talk first about the law governing eminent domain for oil and gas pipelines, then a bit about why some of these changes have come about, and then some examples of particular projects that have been the subject of controversy, some of which Ilya mentioned, some not. So first, if you think about eminent domain for oil and natural gas infrastructure, on the gas side, citing an eminent domain for interstate natural gas pipelines is all at the federal level as a result of the Natural Gas Act of 1938. So it's been that way for a long time. So the gas company seeks a certificate of public convenience and necessity from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And if it's granted, the company can bring an eminent domain action in its own name to condemn the land necessary to build the pipeline if it can't obtain voluntary easements from all the landowners. When it comes to oil pipelines, eminent domain for interstate and intrastate oil pipelines is all governed solely by state law. So a pipeline company needs to obtain eminent domain authority separately in every state in which the pipeline will travel. Some states require that the company obtain a certificate of need prior to building a pipeline and exercising eminent domain, but many do not. So for instance, in Texas, an oil pipeline company simply needs to check a box saying it's a common carrier, and it goes ahead and builds its pipeline, and it can use eminent domain. There's no state or local government approval process at all. Now, almost all states, there's just a couple of exceptions, have legislatively granted oil pipelines eminent domain authority. Colorado is one notable exception, although that's only been recently. So a couple years ago, the Colorado Supreme Court had to deal with a challenge by a landowner saying that the statute granting eminent domain authority for energy and water infrastructure applied only to public utilities. So oil pipelines were not included. The Colorado Supreme Court looked at the statute and agreed and said, nope, oil pipelines are not included, no eminent domain for oil pipelines. So that's really, until this past year, the only state where there's no eminent domain for oil pipelines. The Colorado legislature was thinking of changing the statute to allow it, but so far that hasn't happened. I want to talk a little bit about the connection or lack thereof between the Kelo case and the Kelo legislative backlash on eminent domain for energy infrastructure. Really almost none of the state eminent domain reforms after the Kelo case addressed eminent domain for pipelines and other energy infrastructure. I always found that ironic because this is eminent domain by a private party and not the government. But property rights groups didn't seem that interested in reforming laws that allowed private party eminent domain actions. And this is something that I wrote about at the time. And the reason why I find it curious is that in order for a governmental entity to exercise eminent domain, there needs to be a public process with citizen input, vote by a city council or a county board. And these elected officials, of course, can be voted out of office if the public doesn't like its decisions. There's really no process like that for private party eminent domain actions for oil and gas pipelines. So there's much less protection for the public from private eminent domain than there is for government eminent domain, even before any reforms post-Kelo. But no one really paid attention to this except the property owners in the path of pipelines until the late 2000s. And that's when everything changed when it came to energy infrastructure. So in the late 2000s, oil and gas operators were able to utilize new technologies of directional drilling and hydraulic fracturing to extract oil and gas from shale rock formations. Geologists always knew these resources were there, but there was no way to cost-effectively extract the resources. So starting in about 2006, this technology was implemented on a widespread basis, and all of a sudden, with almost no warning, the U.S. was in a fossil fuel renaissance with new sources of oil in Texas and Oklahoma and North Dakota, and large new natural gas resources, both in these locations as well as further east in the Marcellus Shale region of Pennsylvania and Ohio. Now, most of our major oil and gas infrastructure was built from about 1950 to 1970. This is before we had a lot of strong environmental organizations and also prior to some of the property rights groups that are prominent today. But now, with all this new oil and gas, we needed a lot of new pipelines to transport it to refineries for oil and to customers for gas. So we've had a huge infrastructure build out since about 2006, 2007. And this has occurred at precisely the same time that environmental groups and others have rallied to encourage the U.S. to move away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy in both the electricity and the transportation sectors. This also all occurred just a few years after the Kelo decision, but really not soon enough for the post-Kelo reforms, which really have emboldened property owners and property rights groups to question not only government claims of public use, but also oil and gas company claims of public use once these knocks on the door by these companies have become more frequent. So there's been a lot of recent controversies, both with regard to natural gas pipelines and oil pipelines. So on the gas side, environmental groups, particularly the Sierra Club, have conducted constant protests at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission as the commissions consider certificates of need for natural gas pipelines, for liquefied natural gas terminals, and other infrastructure that is approved and where eminent domain is granted at the federal level. There's also activity going on at the state level. So even though it's the federal government who grants the siting permit and allows the exercise of eminent domain for natural gas pipelines, states do have some authority to block these projects under the Clean Water Act and the Coastal Zone Management Act, even after they've been approved by FERC. And New York State did this just a few months ago for the Constitution Pipeline that's proposed to transport natural gas from Pennsylvania to New York. And there's quite a bit of litigation underway with regard to that. On oil pipelines, clearly the Keystone XL pipeline, people have been following for a long time, the pipeline from Canada down to Texas. Lots of controversy with regard to Nebraska. The only reason the federal government was involved in that pipeline was because of the international border crossing. So that's why it needed State Department approval. But separate and apart from that, Nebraska, at the time the pipeline was proposed, did not have any approval process for pipelines. They could just come in and exercise eminent domain. Because of concerns over the Keystone XL pipeline, they enacted new legislation to have some state approval process for the pipeline. So frankly, regardless of what happens with Keystone XL, as most of you know, President Obama denied the presidential permit. That could, of course, be reevaluated at a later time. But Nebraska is an example of how a controversial pipeline has resulted in major changes in state siting and eminent domain law. They really had no law in place before, and now they do. South Carolina and Georgia, Ilya mentioned the Palmetto pipeline that's caused a huge amount of controversy in those states. Both states have since enacted legislation creating a moratorium on pipeline takings for a few years. But even before that, the Attorney General for South Carolina in 2015 issued a written opinion on whether the pipeline could exercise eminent domain both under the South Carolina statute governing eminent domain as well as the South Carolina Constitution. With regard to the statute, he concluded that most likely authority was limited to public utilities, kind of using the same analysis that the Colorado Supreme Court did. But then he went on to answer the question of whether a privately owned oil pipeline was a public use, even if the pipeline was a common carrier, and actually looked at the Kelo case and South Carolina courts interpreting their own state constitution and said that South Carolina has interpreted its public use clause very narrowly to ban economic development takings, and therefore that would likely apply to oil pipelines in the state as well. There's some other pipeline controversies you may have heard of that are pretty current. The Dakota Access Bakken Pipeline, there's lots of opposition to that pipeline through Iowa. And then the Sandpiper Pipeline in my state of Minnesota, where environmental groups and others have opposed the pipeline in environmental and other grounds and actually received a favorable decision from the Minnesota Court of Appeals that the state environmental review process was not complied with. So in conclusion, this issue is not going to go away as long as we continue to produce new quantities of oil and gas in the United States. These resources have little value without the infrastructure needed to transport them to processing facilities and markets. It may be that these obstacles will help with environmental group efforts to move the country away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy. It may be that these alignments between property rights advocates and environmental groups may last for a while. But frankly, even if we ultimately replace fossil fuels with renewable energy, the property rights and eminent domain concerns are not going to go away. We're going to have similar ones with wind farms, with solar farms, and the electric transmission lines needed to transport those renewable energy resources. So I think that it really requires a conversation in this country about how we build infrastructure, how landowners should be compensated, and how we're going to spread the costs and benefits of infrastructure within the nation as a whole. So I think I'll stop now and turn it over to Dean.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. I do want to give Ilya and Professor Soman and Professor Klass another round here, a shorter round. But before we do that, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So to begin queuing up with your questions, once again, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll take the questions in the order in which you ring in. But before we do that, let's go back to Professor Soman for 2 to 3 minutes. Professor Soman.
Thank you, and thanks to Alexander for a very thoughtful presentation. I just have a couple of comments. One is, Alexander is absolutely right that in many cases, even if there is a common carrier requirement, often companies can just get through it just by checking a box. However, I would note that in the state of Texas, Alexander mentioned, the courts have actually been cracking down on this. And over the last few years, both the Texas Supreme Court and most recently a Texas Intermediate Appellate Court have struck down pipeline takings where there wasn't really sufficient evidence that the condemnation was for something that is a real common carrier as opposed to a box checked off on a form. So if this is possible to do even in Texas, which is certainly not a state hostile to energy producers, hopefully we can enforce this more rigorously in other states as well. I'd also like to talk very briefly about the reaction to Kelo and its relationship to these sorts of takings. As Alex mentioned at first, that reaction didn't do much at all with respect to pipeline takings. The sort of sinister explanation for this might be, the reaction was driven primarily, at first at least, by many people on the right, and they were friendly with energy companies, perhaps. But I think that actually doesn't fully explain it, because many on the left also participated in the backlash against Kelo. I think the bigger explanation is first that until the recent energy boom, there actually had not been very many pipeline takings for a long time. And second, as I mentioned in my other presentation, my earlier presentation, it is actually the case that pipeline takings, at least as a general rule, usually don't displace quite as many people as conventional economic development or blight condemnations, similar to what you had in the Kelo case itself. Obviously, with the recent explosion of these sorts of takings, the scale of potential abuses and harm has also increased. Finally, with respect to environmental consequence of these takings, it may be worth distinguishing between two kinds of problems. One is local environmental harms caused by damage directly from the pipeline itself through leakage or through other kinds of damage to wildlife and the environment and the like. The other is more potentially global harms of the sort that Alexander mentioned, where it might contribute to global warming, the burning of fossil fuels and the like. I think restricting pipeline taking sometimes is a good way to deal with these sorts of local harms. I'm more skeptical that it's a good way to deal with the problem of global warming, which I think is a genuine issue, but the better way to approach it, if it can be solved at all, is through more general measures such as carbon taxation or the like, rather than trying to attack individual projects like this in a very piecemeal way, which often might not be very efficient and will rarely, if ever, make a real difference to this very large global problem. So that said, I turn it over to Alexandra for her response, and I look forward to questions.
Great. Well, just a few thoughts here. One, just follow up on oil pipelines in Texas. So Ilya is absolutely right that the courts have scrutinized some of these the public use claims by pipelines, but the one in particular I think that Ilya may be talking about was a carbon dioxide pipeline as opposed to an oil pipeline, and it was carbon dioxide that was being piped in to be used in the oil company's own operations as opposed to sort of transporting oil as a common carrier. And so the court said, no, that's really, you're not a common carrier, that's for your own private use. But the court was very clear to say, we're not limiting at all oil pipelines in Texas. So we'll have to see what the courts do and how much they really do scrutinize both the common carrier requirement and eminent domain, because Texas has not had a history of trying to stand in the way of oil pipelines. The other two points that I just wanted to raise, one was on, Yo-Yo mentioned, and I did as well, that this new coalition of environmental groups and property rights advocates. And there's an interesting history here, because national environmental groups, at least, really didn't pay much attention to oil and gas pipelines until this most recent build-out of infrastructure after the fracking boom. They really focused on electric transmission lines, because oil pipelines and gas pipelines, once they were built, they were underground. Certainly they cared about the localized environmental impacts, but a lot more focus was on opposing electric transmission lines, which could always be seen because they were above ground and had adverse aesthetic and visibility impacts. Now, of course, that's flipped, because you need new transmission lines if you want to have more wind energy in the system. So you see environmental groups, at least at the national level, not opposing electric transmission lines like they used to. And because of some of these climate change concerns, the national groups are now joining forces with the property rights folks. Local environmental groups, like local chapters of the Sierra Club, have always been concerned about the localized impacts. And I don't necessarily disagree that legislation is a more effective and efficient way of dealing with climate change than individual projects. But the fact remains that you're seeing that now. You're seeing national groups get involved in some of these oil and gas pipeline disputes as a result of not only localized environmental impacts, but also climate change. The last point I just want to make is on reforms, what we do about this. Ilya mentioned this a bit at the end of his opening presentation. So Ilya and I have always disagreed on the validity of the Kelo case and the benefits or harms of government economic development takings. But we tend to agree on a lot of the solutions for private partakings when it comes to oil and gas pipelines. I also believe that we need eminent domain to build infrastructure in this country. I don't think the solution is to get rid of it, but I do think that we need more enhanced procedures, environmental reviews, and checks, particularly when it comes to these private party takings, where there are very few of those right now. So you don't want to make it too easy for private companies to exercise eminent domain, but to the extent that we continue to build oil pipelines, build natural gas pipelines, build electric transmission lines, and build more infrastructure, both for our existing energy resources as well as to transition to cleaner energy resources, that infrastructure is needed, and I think eminent domain can play a role.
I thank you both. This is Dean Reuter again. The floor is open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like we begin the day with five questions. Before we go to that first caller, let me make a quick announcement about upcoming calls. Tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, we'll be discussing the ethics violations and sanctions in the Texas immigration case that probably everybody on this call is familiar with. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Wednesday, also at 2 p.m., we'll host a call with the West Virginia Solicitor General Albert Lynn previewing the Clean Power Plan en banc argument in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which happens later next month. It could be one of the most important circuit court cases argued in a great while. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. Today, of course, it's about pipeline takings. We're on the call with Professors Klass and Soman. Five questions on the board here. Let's take our first question of the day. Go ahead, caller. If you've put your phone on mute, you need to come off mute to ask a question. We can.
Thank you, Dean. It's Warren Belmar. I want to congratulate the two professors for excellent presentations, and especially on a program sponsored by the Federalist Society, because this is a federalism issue. The Constitution has given authority to both the federal government and the states to engage in eminent domain, and the question is, how will the federal government and or each individual state choose to proceed? What we have, and what Professor Klass has indicated quite clearly, is some are concerned with having more pipelines for the development of fossil fuels, but if we don't have the availability of fossil fuels, especially with 200 million cars on the road that primarily run on gasoline. We will have to replace that energy source with something else. And Professor Klass has noted that one of the main areas for advancing a clean energy program would have to be generation of electricity from wind and solar. And that requires the use of eminent domain in order to acquire the opportunity for transmission lines to transmit that newly generated clean energy from remote areas where wind farms and solar farms are developed into the grid where the population is. And there we have, as she noted, a provision where it's the states that have the authority for granting eminent domain authority for such projects. At the federal level, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission only has authority for eminent domain grants for natural gas pipelines. However, there are a number of federal agencies called power marketing administrations that were created during the New Deal that do have eminent domain authority for transmission lines within their geographic jurisdictions. And they are the unsung, unutilized general powers that do exist for eminent domain to try to bring clean energy to the marketplace. But as we proceed, I think we have to have a policy decision, both with respect to fossil fuels and clean energy uses of eminent domain. And that really comes down to a public decision. And at the federal level, we seem to have given that power to the FERC, and at the state level, each state's legislation. And I guess the question is, in any given state, what is it that you want your statute to provide, and not leave it for the courts to try to interpret a statute that was passed years earlier that did not take into account the concerns of today's populace. So I would want to know what efforts are afoot that you all are aware of in state legislatures to update their eminent domain statutes so as to either provide greater flexibility or less flexibility on state approval of projects that require eminent domain.
Who wants to take a first shot at that question?
I can go ahead. So, you know, of course, we've talked about activities in Georgia and in the legislatures in Georgia and South Carolina where they are making it more difficult to use eminent domain for oil pipelines. But in some ways, that's less of a broad policy decision than simply opposition to a particular pipeline. And a lot of times that's how these laws get passed. On electric transmission lines, which is actually an area that I do even more research in and writing in than oil and gas pipelines, there has been some activity in terms of allowing, both allowing and disallowing, depending on the state, merchant transmission lines and others who are, you know, in the business, in more of the business of creating these longer transmission lines to transmit wind energy. Clean Line Energy Partners is one of these merchant transmission lines. Some states have made it easier for them to get public utility status as a transmission line company to be able to go through the approval process. Other states like Arkansas have enacted legislation to prevent them from doing that. And, you know, my own view is that there needs to be a greater federal role in interstate electric transmission line siting and eminent domain, simply because this is vast interstate infrastructure where you need to take regional and national needs into account. All of these laws were passed at a time when our electric grids were fairly localized. It made sense for the states to be in charge. I don't think that is the case today. The Department of Energy is starting to try to use some of its small authority that it has through these power marketing authorities to grant approval to some of these lines. One is called the Plains and Eastern Clean Line that the Department of Energy just attempted to approve to override Arkansas's opposition to that. But at least under federal law, it's still limited what the federal government can do. I think it's less important for the federal government to be involved in oil pipelines only because there are multiple ways to transport oil. We can use rail, we can use ships, we can use pipelines. So there's alternative ways to get oil to refineries and markets. But at least for now, until we get really cool battery technology in place, right now the only way to transport electricity is through transmission lines. So it's kind of a bottleneck. And to have the states in charge of it, I think, is making it difficult for us to be able to integrate the wind and solar energy that we could into the grid. So those are my views.
So just briefly on this, I already mentioned a few of the reforms that I think would be desirable. One is not all of them need to be legislative. I think courts should more rigorously enforce the public use provisions of both state and federal constitutions, which would mean striking down some of these pipeline takings that are not for genuine common carriers. Second, even for those that are common carriers, I think legislative reforms and in some cases judicial enforcement can do more to ensure that the takings are really necessary for the project in question, enforcing a doctrine of necessity. And then finally, I think state governments should impose more rigorous cost-benefit analysis on proposed pipeline condemnations, requiring there to be strong evidence that there are large net economic benefits that will actually be produced. I think whether it should be state or federal takings may depend to some extent on the kind of infrastructure we're talking about. Alexander made some good points on that just now. I would note that historically, it was not always assumed that the federal government had its own general power of eminent domain. In fact, for the first 100 years of American history, most people assumed the opposite, that the power of eminent domain was not one of the enumerated powers of the federal government. It was only in 1875 that the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government did have the power of eminent domain, and the analysis that they used to justify it was in many ways kind of weak. If you're interested in this history, Will Bodd of the University of Chicago Law School has an excellent article we published a couple years ago called Rethinking the Federal Eminent Domain Power, where he showed that under the original meaning of the Constitution and the way it was understood for many decades thereafter, probably at the very least there isn't a general federal power of eminent domain, though possibly there was one for more narrowly specified purposes.
Well, I would leave it at the federal standard being public convenience and necessity, and that's what the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission uses when it passes on gas pipelines, and I think Professor Klass has raised an excellent point on whether there ought to be a debate at the national level on whether it's the national government that ought to make a decision with respect to transmission lines, or if it's better left as decisions of individual states, recognizing that if a state opposes a pipeline across its jurisdiction, it could stop the interstate transmission of clean energy by not having a pipeline transmission line constructed to be able to accommodate this new source of clean energy. And it'd be interesting to see how that debate plays out over the coming years as clean energy becomes more and more popular.
We've got a little more than 15 minutes left. Our questions are multiplying now. We've got 5 questions pending on the board, so now let's take another call.
Good afternoon. This is Jeff Shaw from the Institute for Justice. This is a question for Professor Klass, largely regarding the clean line, transmission line across Arkansas that she had referenced earlier, and the Department of Energy's first ever attempt to use its eminent domain power that it is claiming it has under the Energy Policy Act to take land for that transmission line. But the Act specifically requires that the federal approval of any of these lines conform with state siting laws for transmission lines. So I'm curious if you think this is a federal overreach of their statutory power, or whether they actually have a viable claim to use their eminent domain power for this transmission line. Thanks.
Sure. So I think there's decent case law that supports the Department of Energy's position. There have been other cases, I think one's in the Ninth Circuit, one's in the Eighth Circuit. These are older cases that says, well, the federal government's involved in proposing the line. They don't have to follow, just based on supremacy clause, they don't have to follow state siting procedures. They don't need a state public use determination. They don't need to follow state eminent domain procedures, and they don't need a state siting permit. And my recollection from the approval document for the Clean Line project is Department of Energy is looking to those cases and looking to that authority that the courts have upheld in the past that support their ability to override a state like Arkansas's rejection under their own state law. Is it a slam dunk win for the Department of Energy? No, this is the first time they've attempted to use this authority that they were granted by Congress in the Energy Policy Act of 2005. And I don't think there have been lawsuits filed yet. I anticipate that there will, so we'll see what the
courts do. There was one filed 2 weeks ago.
Was there? Okay, good. I anticipated that.
We're following it.
Yeah. So I've got, and Jim Rossi at Vanderbilt and I actually have an article that'll be coming out in the next several months looking at the Department of Energy's approval of the Clean Line project and comparing and contrasting that with New York State's disapproval of the Constitution pipeline and looking at some of the federalism issues that are going on with regard to gas pipelines and electric transmission lines. So looking at exactly that issue, and there will be a lot more activity.
Let's carry on with our questions now. We've still got 5 questions pending, so we're answering questions, but provoking questions as well. Let's take our next call.
Hi, this is Matt Rackety calling from Toronto. First of all, thanks to everyone for speaking to this important topic. I just have a quick question, mainly on the durability of the this new alliance, the strange bedfellows that we have between property rights advocates and then those who I think we can say are advocating for a greening of the infrastructure, including energy infrastructure, and the obvious tension that's going to be there with respect to efforts to develop green infrastructure, as has been alluded to earlier on, and whether this is even a very strong coalition right now, and how long it can really last in view of the fact that the advocates for the green infrastructure are of course going to, in many cases, prefer to utilize a robust eminent domain power in order to build out the infrastructure. Thanks.
Yeah, so it's a good question by Matt, who's actually one of my former students from George Mason. I certainly agree that these groups are not going to be an alliance on all issues related to energy and eminent domain, but I think it does seem like the coalition has staying power, at least when it comes to pipeline takings, and the last couple of years have shown that it might have more influence than I at least at first thought that they would, and that they did pass these laws in South Carolina and Georgia, and there have been other efforts that have had some success in other states. So I think what you're probably going to see, at least for as long as there are a lot of pipeline takings being considered, that this alliance will continue on that issue, but certainly that's not to say that these groups are going to agree on everything related to eminent domain or everything related to energy infrastructure and the like. When you often have alliances that are between ideologically disparate groups, obviously they may have very different reasons for why they oppose some particular kind of government activity, and those reasons may apply in some areas much more than they do in others.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think these alliances are going to coalesce around particular individual projects, and they're going to be ones that all the parties oppose. So on electric transmission lines, you're going to see some of the environmental groups be either neutral or in favor because of the clean energy potential. So you're probably not going to have alliance with property rights groups on those. With regard to fossil fuel infrastructure, whether it's oil pipelines or gas pipelines and related infrastructure, I think for now you're going to see those alliances, and they really became much more visible with Keystone XL, where you saw really, really strong environmental advocates working with the property rights folks and landowners and ranchers. And I just think that's now carrying over into other fossil fuel infrastructure. So I think that's where we're going to see it. It's going to be on particular projects, and it's going to be focused primarily on fossil fuel projects.
We've hit the 10-minute mark here. We've got three questions pending, so let's try and get to these final questions, and I'll ask the callers to be as concise as possible.
I just wanted to say really quick thank you, and I have a very short, but it is a three-part question. One, I just wanted to see if your analysis here, in your opinion, applied equally to private companies and water pipelines. The second part is whether you maybe generally thought it might be easier to satisfy the public use requirements for, you know, drinking water transmission. And finally, just wanted to know if you had any knew of any case law examples with regard to this issue and water lines. Thank you so much.
So, in brief answer, in my view, both the constitutional and legislative rules that I think should apply to oil pipelines should also apply to water lines. However, in most cases, water lines, at least those for drinking water, will in fact be public utilities, so they can meet even a relatively narrow definition of public use because they're legally required to serve the entire public in a given area. My understanding, and Alexandra can correct me if I'm wrong, is that in recent years there hasn't been any great explosion of takings for water lines. Much of the water infrastructure for drinking water and the like was built decades ago. So while legally speaking, sometimes there would be similar issues, in recent years, this hasn't been as controversial because there hasn't been as much of it. Also, obviously, water pipelines carry, on average at least, less risk of environmental damage than pipelines that convey oil or gas.
I would agree with Ilya's analysis. The one thing that I would add, though, is, you know, because of concerns about aging water infrastructure and concerns about lead with the Flint, Michigan crisis, we may, in my view, hopefully in the future, see a lot more build out of that infrastructure and replacement of that infrastructure. And it may be that some of those projects will be controversial, although for the most part, my guess would be that those water pipes and pipelines would be built in the same location that they already exist, so you're not needing new easements or new land to do that in the way that you are seeing with these new oil and gas pipelines and transmission lines. So you already have the land, so it may not be as much of a problem, at least with regard to eminent domain. But I agree that these are mostly public utilities or owned by the public, and so it would meet a very narrow definition of public use.
Very good. Let's move on to our next caller.
Yes, hello. First of all, my name is Alan Dixler. I'm in New Jersey. I want to thank you very much for an excellent and thought-provoking program. I assume, at least in the reformed eminent domain statutes, that there is a concept that this should be a last resort, that even if it's constitutional, it's still undesirable to take the property of someone who really does not want to sell it at what's viewed as the prevailing market price. In that vein of last resort, do other alternative means come into play? In other words, as was alluded to before, in the case of the transmission of either crude oil or refined petroleum products, they don't have to move by pipeline. In my part of the world, there's an awful lot moving by rail and by water. The fact that there are other alternatives, does that go into the analysis of what constitutes a last resort, as contrasted, for example, I think with natural gas? I think that to transport natural gas overland, there's really not much alternative to a pipeline.
So while in discussing these issues politically, people often say, well, this should only be done if it's a last resort. My understanding actually is that this last resort idea is rarely incorporated in the statutes, either for this kind of eminent domain or actually for most other kinds of use of eminent domain. To some extent, as I noted earlier, you could encapsulate this by enforcing necessity requirements more rigorously, but even that what the necessity requirement says is that you have to prove that you really need to take this piece of land for this pipeline or this other public use, which is not quite the same thing as saying you must prove that you need a pipeline or some other condemnation-driven project to achieve the government's goal. I do think that if there's tighter cost-benefit analysis imposed on these takings, that's not quite the same thing as showing that it's a last resort, but it will at least cut down on takings where it's dubious that there really is any significant net benefit being achieved. So while I think I agree on sort of the general intuition that it should only be a last resort, I'm not sure that this is much embedded in current laws, and I'm not sure that the notion of last resort can sort of effectively be implemented directly, though it can be perhaps achieved indirectly through some of these other reforms I just mentioned.
I think there may be some statutes, I can't cite any right now, that may require before you use eminent domain that you show you've made a good effort to obtain voluntary easements with landowners, or you've gotten a certain percentage of landowners signed up and you only need eminent domain for the rest. I could be wrong on that, but I seem to have some recollection of that, at least in some states. As a practical matter, my understanding is oil and gas companies and electric utilities and merchant transmission line operators, even if it's not required by law that they use eminent domain as a last resort, they absolutely want to use it as a last resort because they don't want to be tied up in litigation. They don't want to have to deal with all these eminent domain actions in multiple states. So there's a big economic incentive for them to pay much more than fair market value to get voluntary easements. And my understanding is that, at least for most oil and gas pipelines, they're only using eminent domain, if at all, for a very small percentage of the easements that they need, like 5% or less, just because the economic incentives are so strong to avoid that type of litigation.
Can I comment slightly further on this? I certainly agree that in many cases they get the land without formally resorting to eminent domain and that they prefer to do it that way, but often the threat of eminent domain is what gets people to sell quote-unquote voluntarily. I discussed this at some length in my book on Kelo and its aftermath. Moreover, while sometimes above market rates are paid, many studies show that in many cases people whose property is condemned don't even get the fair market value that, constitutionally speaking, according to Supreme Court, they're supposed to get. So this is actually one of those areas where the law in the books or in the U.S. reports doesn't always get effectively implemented on the ground. I'm not aware of too many studies focusing specifically on pipeline takings in this regard, but it's a real problem with a lot of other kinds of takings.
We've got just a couple minutes left. We've got a couple questions on the board here yet. Let me open the floor to these final two questions, and then we'll let our experts respond to either or both of them as they wish. Go ahead, caller, and please try to be as succinct as possible.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And I was wondering if the Federal Society had an ongoing forum or discussion group about this whole idea of what is federal sovereignty relative to infrastructure. Specifically, we're getting ready to start build the physical internet, and you're seeing this with Hyperloop and JPODS and other transportation alternatives that are clean energy and the federal violation of eminent domain that built the interstates created a problem, but we need an ongoing forum to have discussions.
Yeah, this is Dean Reuter. It's interesting. We don't have an ongoing forum beyond our regular programming, our teleforum conference calls, our in-person programming, and our scholarship. But I'd be happy to discuss that with you offline if you want to discuss some possibilities there. And
great.
With that, okay. I'm sorry I cut that caller off, but do feel free to reach out to me. And now let's take our final question of the day. Go ahead, caller.
It's Warren Belmar again, just to clarify some earlier discussion about the Arkansas transmission litigation. It's not necessarily the Department of Energy that has the authority, although under Section 1222 of the Energy Policy Act of 2005, the Power Marketing Administrations, which are part of the Department of Energy, which already have eminent domain authority, were authorized to partner with transmission line proposals to lend its, or to participate as a co-owner, if you will, of a new pipe, a new transmission line, and thereby the private company, Clean Line in this instance, gains access to the Power Marketing Administration's statutory authority with respect to eminent domain. So it's not necessarily the Energy Policy Act itself that creates the eminent domain opportunity for transmission lines. It's the New Deal legislation creating the Power Marketing Administration's and determining that this was a national issue. Of course, that authority was used to build Hoover Dam and Grand Coulee Dam and all of the electric transmission lines in the West when there were none. And it's that basic authority that is now being used by the Power Marketing Administrations to assist others for building clean transmission line capabilities.
Yes, the caller is correct in the sense that what the Energy Policy Act of 2005, Section 1222, did was confirm that the Power Marketing Administrations could enter into those partnerships as opposed to needing to get separate congressional legislation for particular lines, which they did in the past. So that's right.
Okay. Well, having served as the Deputy General Counsel for Energy Policy at the Department of Energy when the Policy Act was adopted and then our efforts to implement it, I became quite familiar with this, and it took a California case, as you indicated, in the Ninth Circuit to allow for the completion of transmission from Northwest into California to solve a crisis that they were having on lack of adequate electricity availability. And without the transmission lines, we're going to be faced with blackouts again. And so the question is, what is the federal role in making sure that a blackout in one state does not cause a blackout across the whole nation or large sectors of the nation as occurred in 2003?
On that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We are out of our budgeted time, but we're also out of questions. So with that, my thanks to both our experts, Professor Alexandra Klass and Professor Ilya Soman. This has been a very interesting and informative discussion. I thank you both. To our audience, thank you as well for your questions and for dialing in. A reminder about our next scheduled telephone conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing the Texas immigration case and how that was handled, some ethical violations and a judge's order there. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.